From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Saints and Sinners. Making Saints is a new book that investigates how the Vatican decides who is worthy of being canonized as a saint. We'll talk with author Kenneth Woodward, the religion editor of Newsweek. Also today, writer Anthony Holden tells us about his year as a professional poker player, making his way around the world, playing all the big tournaments, winning and losing at all the casinos. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new album from the Traveling Wilburys, and Stephen Schiff reviews Kevin Costner's new film, Dances with Wolves. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush sent a signal to Iraq's Saddam Hussein today by announcing the deployment of additional troops to put the U.S. and allied forces in a strong offensive position. The announcement coincides with new assurances that the Soviet Union will support the use of military force as a last resort. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
The president preceded the announcement by saying his earlier decisions to deploy troops to Saudi Arabia were applauded by Congress and the American people. And it's with those assurances he's taking the next step of boosting U.S. troop levels to put the multinational force in an offensive position.
I can't say whether, after this is completed, whether there will be anything else done or not. I mean, I'm still hopeful that Saddam Hussein will get the message that he is not going to prevail.
The president declined to say how many additional troops would be sent. Defense Secretary Dick Cheney said Army, Marine, and Navy forces would be involved, along with hundreds of battle tanks. Asked outright if the U.S. is now going to war against Iraq, the president shook his head and said he wants to see a peaceful solution. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the White House.
Soviet Foreign Minister Edward Shevardnadze today gave the strongest signal yet that the Kremlin may support the use of force to resolve the crisis in the Persian Gulf. NPR's Ann Cooper reports from Moscow.
Shevardnadze told reporters tonight that military force in the Gulf probably cannot be ruled out. But the foreign minister indicated that for now, the Soviet Union still prefers to search for political ways to oust the Iraqi occupiers from Kuwait. Shevardnadze's emphasis on a political solution implies continued Soviet reluctance to support a new United Nations resolution authorizing use of force against Iraq. Shevardnadze was speaking after several hours of meetings here with Secretary of State James Baker. Baker's on an international mission to fortify opposition to the Iraqi occupation. He did not appear to win any major new commitments from the Kremlin today, but after meeting briefly with reporters tonight, Baker and Shevardnadze went off to continue their talks about the Gulf. I'm Ann Cooper in Moscow.
Oil prices shot up this afternoon on rumors that the United States would attempt to resupply its embassy in Kuwait City using military force if necessary. The rumors said that President Bush would announce the mission at his news conference this afternoon. Even though the president's announcement only concerned the additional troop deployment to the Persian Gulf, prices went up. On the New York Mercantile Exchange, prices gained more than $1.50 a barrel to $35.53. Prices edged up slightly today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 3 points to close at 2,443.81. Advances led declines by a margin of 4-3 in moderate trading. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Christianity is unthinkable without sinners, unlivable without saints, writes Kenneth Woodward in his new book, Making Saints. Woodward has been the religion editor of Newsweek for 26 years. His new book investigates how the Roman Catholic Church decides who becomes a saint. It's a process intended to reflect God's judgment, but in reality, it gets bogged down in bureaucracy. Woodward says there's a tendency to confuse the mysterious ways of God with the unnecessarily mystifying ways of the saint-making process. I asked Woodward why he wanted to investigate this process.
Well, you know, I didn't know how it worked, and I don't think most Roman Catholics know how this works, nor do most people in the Vatican really know how it works, nor do they know about the changes that took place. That's one reason. The other reason is I think that when you step back and look at this religion called Christianity, and this is in its Catholic form, that all the adherents are called to be saints. And then I got to thinking, too, about the decline and the cultural saliency of saints. We still have, we venerate, in effect, artists, less so politicians, warriors from in certain innings. But the saint has really slipped from our view, and I think we've lost something considerable when we lose it.
What's the function of saints in the eyes of the church?
Well, in the eyes of the church, it's to provide contemporary and therefore relevant models of behavior for the faithful, and to say that you can be a follower of Christ and yet this way as well. My problem is that all the models tend to look the same. They're turning out the same model every year, and I think they need some variety.
As you point out in the book, a lot of people pray to saints for miracles or for favors. Do you think that there's been a kind of deterioration in the relationship between Roman Catholics and their saints?
Oh, there certainly has. I mean, since Vatican Council II, they've tried to curb, which was an excessive and sometimes idolatrous devotion to saints. I mean, you know the old joke, they say, go to Italy and stop anybody on the street and ask them if they believe in God, and they'll say no, but Mary is his mother. They felt there's a certain deflection taking place, and therefore a correction should take place. But I think now that that's happened, we ought to begin to appreciate saints and appreciate them not so much as people as figures to pray to, at least this is my judgment, but as stories to tell. And if they are told well, they can provide the kind of literature on which the Middle Ages thrived. And I love the old stories of the early Roman martyrs. They're legend and apocryphal and so forth, but they're absolutely wonderful folk literature.
Can you give us a very brief overview of how saints are selected?
Yes, let's begin with the notion that there are many, many more saints than they could possibly want to canonize. So if you are selected, how are they done it? How do they do it? Well, the first thing is that it's in the beginning phases, it's the most democratic process in a not terribly democratic church, which is to say a reputation for holiness has to be developed after the death of someone. We think so-and-so is a saint. We demonstrate it by going to his tomb. We invoke his name. We talk it up. We issue a prayer card. Then a group gets behind it called the promoters. And if they make enough noise and make a significant enough case, a bishop must take it up. The key player is the bishop. If he doesn't take up the cause and make it official, nothing happens locally or in Rome. Then he investigates the person's life. Did they die as a martyr or were they heroically virtuous? He gathers everything they've written about them, everything written by them and about them. They call in witnesses. And when they get all the documentation, they're satisfied that there's a good chance for a saint here. They send it on to Rome. Rome looks the material over, creates what I want to call a historical, critical, spiritual biography, complete with footnotes and so forth. This is given to a panel of 9 theologians. If 2/3 approve, it goes to a panel of similar number of cardinals and bishops. And if they approve, it goes to the Pope. He calls them the person venerable. Then they bring on a miracle, and it is judged by a panel of doctors in Rome as to whether it is medically explicable or inexplicable. Then it's passed to the theologians if it's termed inexplicable, who then determine whether it is a possible miracle here. And then it goes on to the Pope. You need one miracle for beatification, one more for canonization.
In 1983, there were some reforms in the system. What were the changes?
Well, they were really enormous, and it's been muffled. You don't hear about it. But we've all heard of the devil's advocate. It's a wonderful phrase, novel by that name and so forth. The process for making saints was a juridical process. It was in the hands of canon lawyers. And certainly well into this century, it had the reputation for being the most exacting and fastidious legal process in the world. Well, as a matter of fact, it wasn't, and there were a lot of complaints. They would very often get witnesses who had only known the candidate for sainthood when the candidate was very old, and now these people were very old. In other words, the oral testimony was not terribly helpful. So they decided to to not make it a legal process anymore. And after 400 years, it isn't. It's more like a PhD dissertation in the sense that there's a man who is like the dissertation master, and he guides the collecting of evidence and the writing of the documents. They've moved to a narrative mode and away from a juridical mode, which was always proving something.
Just gone kind of from the courtroom to the academic model.
Exactly.
Now, what are the politics over which nominations get pursued and which don't? Is there a certain kind of saint that's favored by the church, that the church is more likely to pursue?
Well, I can tell you right now, because this book, after all, is a journalist's report.
Mm-hmm.
And right now, they are dying to have lay saints. That's their top priority. And along with that, they would love to have, because they have too many clergy. They have had too many bishops, too many nuns who were founders of their religious orders and so forth. They would love to have more intellectuals. But the people who are least likely, based on past experience, to be made saints are intellectuals and happily married lay people and popes. There's only been three popes canonized in the last 900 years. If you want to be a saint, don't get yourself elected pope.
You point out in your book that Archbishop Romero, the late Archbishop Romero of El Salvador, is seen as someone who might be a candidate for sainthood. But then you ask the question, if one of the criteria for sainthood is having died as a martyr, can you be a martyr if you died for the cause of peace and justice? Is this a big question that will be confronting the church?
Well, it's confronted within particular categories. The problem with Romero was that he was a political figure and looked to more by the left than certainly from the conservative right. And there was an effort, successful by the Pope, to say, let's not move on him now. Now they are. Now it's official. And I can't imagine that this man is not going to be declared a martyred saint of the church. But he tried to speak for the people. Every saint in a culture like that is a popular figure, is a figure of the people. And the church wants to say, no, he died for the church. That he really, well, he represented both, it seems to me. And in a heavily Catholic country like that, he was able to present himself to the people as speaking for all of them, which, of course, you couldn't do in a pluralistic society like ours. I think he's going to make it. I'm critical of those who say he will not.
Kenneth Woodward is my guest, author of the new book, Making Saints, How the Catholic Church Determines Who Becomes a Saint, Who Doesn't, and Why. Well, you need one miracle for beatification, two miracles to become a saint. What is the meaning of miracle in the 20th century, where there's a very advanced knowledge of science? I mean, I think that, you know, humans' knowledge of the way the world works and the way certain mysterious forces work are very different now than they were 2,000 years ago.
Oh, yes, of course. And there is much discussion and some considerable controversy within the congregation as to whether they should continue to require miracles of healing, because the doctors involved in the process are becoming ever more fastidious. But I disagree, if I may, Terry, with your premise.
Mm-hmm.
The fact of the matter is the notion of miracle, given modern science, is much more acceptable today than it ever was in the heyday of the mechanical Newtonian universe, where there were natural laws to be discovered. We know from studying the micro-entities as well as the macro, the universe, that that happenings have more to do with statistical occurrences and so forth. In other words, we have an image of our world which is porous to things that are inexplicable and so forth. It's really an outdated Enlightenment view to suppose that miracles can't happen. I take the view that a miracle for one who believes in God is a form of gift. I think a lot of us, and myself included at times, do not want to acknowledge that most of the good things that happen to us come in the form of gifts. We have this myth of ourselves as our own sort of self-made people. As a matter of fact, we're not. But the problem in the Vatican is that they are insisting on, they've fallen in bed, actually, with modern medical science. Because the irony is that in order to have a miracle, you have to have modern science to show that it couldn't have happened by any other way except a miracle, you see. And this works to the disadvantage of third world countries which don't have the medical facilities and the record keeping and so forth, all of which is required so that they can rule out any other natural explanation for what takes place.
Give us a sense of what recently has been described as a miracle by the church.
Somebody has a life-threatening disease, certain kinds of cancers, those with high rates spontaneous removal are not included. But a person is almost dead. They have to recover instantaneously, and it has to be completed, and it has to, you know, last the rest of their lives. And they watch these very closely. But there was one case where somebody's foot was, they were born with their toes turned in. It was practically a U, their foot was. And after praying to this candidate for sainthood, within 2 days, the whole thing just stopped, turned around completely. And they brought in doctors to ask whether there was any way this could possibly happen. Well, some of the most impressive writing that I saw were the letters that accompanied the healings that could not be explained. And the doctors are not by any means all Roman Catholic. Obviously, they're Jewish, Protestant, non-believers, and so forth. A lot of things happen in medicine that we don't know, that are not explicable.
So most miracles today are medical in nature. They're people who've had sudden and inexplicable reversals.
That's right. About 99% of them are medical, and they keep insisting on that. Now, there is some movement to talk about non-medical miracles. Supposing someone has been an alcoholic all their life and they suddenly stop overnight and so forth. This has actually been proposed. They are a little wary of this sort of thing, saying, well, supposing the guy falls off the wagon and there's no real healing there. As one of them put it to me, now, if you have an alcoholic, a diagnosed alcoholic, and that person stops and then is able to take a drink again without becoming alcoholic, he says, that would be a miracle.
Clearly. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. My guest is Kenneth Woodward. He's the religion editor for Newsweek magazine, and his new book is called Making Saints, and it's about the process of making saints in the Vatican. This is Fresh Air. Joining us, my guest is Kenneth Woodward. He is the religion editor for Newsweek magazine and author of the new book, Making Saints, How the Catholic Church Determines Who Becomes a Saint, Who Doesn't, and Why. One of the things that the consultants look for in deciding who should be a saint is mystical experiences. And you asked a very interesting question to one of the consultors. You asked, what's the difference between psychological disturbance or, you know, like thinking you're hearing voices because you're schizophrenic? What's the difference between that and heightened spirituality? Was there an example that you were thinking of in particular? And I'd like to hear the response that you got.
Well, my main concern was this. The idea of the mystical life, it's the most interior life of prayer with God. And I thought that they would treat the mystic as a special category, like they do martyrs. And then I discovered that, as a matter of fact, they get very nervous around purported mystical causes because a lot of them have secondary phenomena, like levitation, like reading hearts, which is to say to know what's on somebody's mind before they tell you, the stigmata, which we've seen in a number of individuals and have been authenticated, that is to say the five wounds of Christ in their hands, feet, and in their side. They call it secondary, and they don't like it because the people get very excited, and they say, look, you may walk on water, which has got some biblical precedent to it, but that doesn't make you a saint, because you may take pride in that fact. So they go to study their virtues. And in the same way, when they come across somebody, they look to see what this effect had on their lives. Were they puffed up about it? Did they go on television with it, for example? That would be a very bad case. So there was an instance where I found that it's very good to look at the humble, old-fashioned virtues. Were they prudent? Did they care about other people?
But getting back to the difference between a psychological disturbance like schizophrenia and a heightened spiritual experience, hearing voices coming to you from God, mm-hmm. How does the church determine the difference? Now that we know as much about psychology as we do.
Well, I wish they had more psychologists and psychiatrically trained people in the congregation than they do. As a matter of fact, they don't. But they do have some consultants with some experience along these lines, and I managed to talk to them. I think they all give, like you would imagine a doctor might, they all give their rather personal interpretation of the material that is handed them. I mean, usually they don't have a chance to examine the person. The person's been dead for a long time. All they have is whatever writings or documents are there. I think that they are perfectly willing to say, all right, we see some Freudian symbolism here. One of the cases I study or discuss in the book is Alexandrina da Costa, a rather attractive Portuguese woman who had visions and would go through Jesus's passion. She would go into these ecstasies, and they were rather grim, but she would have visions of Jesus with a straw extending from his breast to hers. Well, that's very Freudian imagery. And they're able to say, well, look, that only takes place in the fantasy. We're trying to get behind these things. The fantasies may, in fact, be Freudian or whatever label you want to put on them. What did they do with these things? Now, if somebody is really and truly sick and is not healed from this, I mean, really psychotic, then they would have a judgment to that effect, and they would dismiss the case.
Kenneth Woodward is my guest, and he's the religion editor for Newsweek magazine and author of the new book, Making Saints, How the Catholic Church Determines Who Becomes a Saint, Who Doesn't, and Why. One of the people up for sainthood now is Dorothy Day, who really gave her life to the poor, and a lot of her greatest admirers don't want to see her become a saint. Why is that?
Well, I can appreciate that. Imagine walking into the church and seeing somebody that you knew, like Dorothy Day, mm-hmm. and I knew Dorothy, and you'd lived with her and admired her and so forth, and suddenly there's this cold statue of her, and it's highly stylized, and you say, hell, that's not Dorothy. You see, and the other problem is that they, when they do these, when they work up these spiritual biographies, and later when they talk about these people, they tend to airbrush any vices that they may have. They want to talk about virtues, and then they become unreal. They become plaster saints. And I think that part of the resistance to having Dorothy even investigated is that they don't want her turned into a plastic saint. As far as they're concerned, she is a saint. We don't need what they consider to be the interference on the part of a bunch of bureaucrats in Rome to satisfy us that, as a matter of fact, she is with God in heaven. And by God, we'll pray to her, but to honor her is to go out and deal with the poor in the same way that she did.
Yeah, well, you write that you're concerned that the saint makers are forced to exclude what is really exemplary in the life of a saint, and that is the struggle that they went through between virtue and vice, between grace and nature. You want to see more of that struggle in the story of the saints.
Yes, I'm thinking of the people who are objecting to turning Dorothy Day into a plaster saint. I happen to think Dorothy Day is a saint, if I understand what a saint is. But I also know that she had her vices. She could be very curt with people and impatient with people. Anyhow, she had her sins, she had her vices. I think it would be much more helpful if when they wrote these documents up and they talked about these people, they didn't put halos around their heads and said, look, no, they were human like us, and they, through the grace of God, they transcended these things. Then you can look at them and you can say, well, yes, they're different from me, but they're also very much like me. Otherwise, they cease to be in any way interesting as models for human behavior. They're impossible models when they've never committed any kind of sin.
What's your final critique of the process of saint-making?
Well, that you've hit on it already. I mean, I think that Saints' stories are important. If they're going to be culturally relevant anymore, we're going to have to learn how to tell their stories truthfully, but in a way that reveals the structure of their experience. And I have suggested that whatever else it may be, that the story of a saint is always a love story, because it's a story of a God who loves and of the beloved who learns how to reciprocate what Dorothy Day called that harsh and dreadful love. We see these figures in Dostoevsky and other places. Why can't we see them coming out of the Vatican?
One last question?
Yeah, go right ahead.
Has this changed the way that you relate to saints yourself?
Oh, I've had saints bred into my bones, so to speak, from an early date. My middle name is Lawrence, and that goes back to St. Lawrence, whose wonderful story about being put in a fiery furnace and announcing 15 minutes later, turn me over, I'm done on this side. I learned that as a child, and you can appropriate those stories to your own sense of identity. I think most of the saints that they make today are not very interesting, and I'm looking forward to Cardinal Newman. But I think, you know, as I used in one of my epigrams, the only sadness is not to be a saint. I used to think the only sadness was not to be an artist, but I've met some artists and I've learned. And we can't all be artists, can we? But we could all be saints. Very democratic. So I suppose I've also learned that I don't really pray to saints. I don't sit and think about these people. I go directly to the source, and I suppose I'm a figure of my own times. But I can imagine other people as saints, and I like the idea of connection that the saint represents. We have in our, if I may go on a moment, we have in our society a sense that we only make connections when we meet each other or we strike a deal or whatever. And the whole saint-making process presumes that between everybody who exists and everybody who ever did exist or who will exist, there is, through God, a deep and fundamental connection, and that we are all connected. So the good that I do affects future generations, and the ill that I do affects generations. And I would like to see us be able to reimagine these connections again. And therefore, the saint is important because he's connected to all of us.
Kenneth Woodward, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Kenneth Woodward is the religion editor for Newsweek and the author of the new book, Making Saints. Next time, Shen Tang, a leader of China's pro-democracy movement. He escaped from China after the massacre at Tiananmen Square and is now a student at Brandeis University, where he continues his work in exile. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Journalist Anthony Holden gave up his Tuesday night poker game for 1 year, but it wasn't to give up poker. He spent that year traveling around the world as a professional poker player. Coming up, the luck of the draw. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new album from the Traveling Wilburys, the collective alter ego of rock stars Bob Dylan, Jeff Lynne, George Harrison, and Tom Petty. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Dances with Wolves. It's Kevin Costner's latest movie and his directorial debut. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Bush and Defense Secretary Richard Cheney held a news conference late this afternoon to announce the deployment of additional U.S. forces to the Persian Gulf. Neither the president nor Cheney would say how many more troops are to be sent, but sources indicate it could be more than 100,000. NPR's Vicki O'Hare reports.
The defense secretary said the ingoing troops are not intended as replacements, but as additions to forces already there. The new deployment is to include forces from both the United States and from among U.S. troops in Germany. It also will include one battleship and three aircraft carrier groups for a total of six in the region. At a briefing later with Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff Colin Powell, Cheney said that for the first time, National Guard units will be called up. The defense secretary said that the combat units will be taken from Georgia, Mississippi, and Louisiana. According to Cheney, the units will receive training here in the United States, after which a decision will be made as to whether to send them to the Persian Gulf. In Washington, this is Vicki O'Hara.
Secretary of State Baker is in Moscow, where Soviet officials have now given qualified approval for the use of military force to get Iraq out of Kuwait if peaceful measures fail. Soviet Foreign Minister Shevardnadze, who earlier said the use of force is not desirable, now says the use of force probably cannot be ruled out. After two meetings between the foreign minister and the Secretary of State, there was speculation the two were working on a UN resolution which would allow the use of force against Iraq. In the Middle East, in the West Bank, an Israeli soldier was fatally stabbed by a Palestinian. As tensions continued in Jerusalem, a day after services for slain Rabbi Meir Kahana, Linda Gradstein reports.
The Druze soldier was serving at the Jenin prison in the West Bank when a Palestinian man stabbed him. The soldier was wearing new protective jackets given to soldiers in the territories, but the man stabbed him in the throat. Another soldier who was stabbed at a roadblock in Gaza today was not injured. Police deployed in force today, the day after Meir Kahana's funeral. Police also arrested seven of Kahana's supporters, including one who called for vengeance at yesterday's funeral. Both Palestinians in East Jerusalem and Israeli Arab leaders, like the mayor of Shfar'am, have received death threats, and police say they will protect them. There have also been threats against journalists and prominent Israeli leftists. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
The Paris-based computer maker Group Bull says that it will cut its U.S. staff by some 2,400 people, which is more than 21% of its domestic workforce. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up 3 points to close at 2,443.81 on volume of some 155 million shares. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Stephen Schiff reviews Kevin Costner's new movie later on the show. When Bob Dylan, Tom Petty, George Harrison, and Jeff Lynne aren't making albums of their own, they sometimes make music together in a band known as the Traveling Wilburys. The late Roy Orbison was also part of the original group. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of the Wilburys' new album.
She gotta put it in the oven, and it's gonna be good. She better not leave me and go out to Hollywood. She's got the best pudding in the neighborhood.
At first, Traveling Wilburys Volume 3 seems hopeless, very annoying indeed. There were cute little jokes surrounding the group's first album, the way they all took false names and invented a whimsical history for this band of pseudo-brothers. But this sweetness has turned sour on the new release, becoming corny and irritating. Why the dumb joke of Volume 3 if this is only the band's second album? Why a new set of silly pseudonyms? Dylan, for example, who was Lucky the first time around, is now Boo. And George Harrison, who was once Nelson, call him Spike. Give me a break. These aging pros even do something here called the Wilbury Twist, for heaven's sakes. It's as if when Roy Orbison died, he took with him all the bracing directness and unironic passion of this group. But that's only how it seems at first.
Look up your chimney. The sky ain't blue. It's kinda yellow. You know it's true.
Pretty quickly, the music on Volume 3 begins to kick in, and much of the corniness is transcended, or at least made enjoyable. For example, the loping blues rock of Where Were You Last Night is terrific, but there's not much you can do with a couplet like Where Were You Last Week, Were You Up a Creek, except grin and bear it. That song takes the hostility toward women that Bob Dylan has been nurturing at least as long as Like a Rolling Stone, and turns his ranting into affable crankiness. It loosens him up, and it proves to be a better song than anything on his own new album, Under the Red Sky.
Where were you last week? Were you up a creek? Did you stay up pacing the floor? Got me.
The best song on this album is also, I think, the most unassuming. It's the lovely New Blue Moon. Dylan croons the verses, they all yowl the chorus, and you can almost hear Roy Orbison's ringing tenor floating over this searching pop melody.
Too many moons have come and gone, and none of them were blue. Too many times the sun came up, but it came up with that.
On their own records, each of these men has his flaws. Dylan is often lazy, Tom Petty can be aimless, George Harrison whines a lot, and Jeff Lynne is neurotically fussy. As Traveling Wilburys, though, they pull themselves together, and the music they make is more casual and certainly more humorous and generous.
I drove around the city. Subscription, then I joined the idol race, and they said store it in a cool dry place. I got guitar, basses, amplifiers and drums, accordions and mandolins and things that sometimes hum, cymbals and harmonicas, capos by the score, and lots of things in boxes laying all around the floor. Some places they.
As Volume 3 works its easygoing charm on you, you realize that it's only by indulging in all that coy Wilbury malarkey that these legends and would-be legends can throw off their heavy fame, relax, and collaborate without supergroup self-consciousness. Do you think they'll make Chubby Checker an honorary Wilbury the next time around?
You Put your hand on your head.
Put your foot in the air.
Then you hop around the room.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly.
Lift your other foot up.
Fall on your ass.
Get back up. Put your teeth in the glass. Ain't never been nothing quite like this. It's a magical thing called the Wilbur Twist.
This is Fresh Air. Anthony Holden spent a year as a professional poker player. He was the one at the table taking notes. Holden is a journalist. He's written biographies of Prince Charles and Laurence Olivier. He's also worked for the London Sunday Times and The Observer. But his new book is about his year playing poker for big stakes in gaudy casinos around the world. It's called Big Deal. Holden is a veteran of Tuesday night poker games. I asked him what it means to turn pro in a game played by millions of amateurs.
Well, a pro is basically somebody who earns a living doing it, which is not easy to do. But there are several hundred people, mostly in the western United States, who manage that. And there's a handful of Europeans. And what they do is spend their year traveling around a circuit. Poker has a circuit, like golf or tennis has a circuit, punctuated by various big-time tournaments. And, of course, old-time hustling still goes on. At a phone call, they'll get on a plane and go anywhere where the action is.
Now, why did you want to turn pro for a year?
Well, it happened to me by mistake, really. It comes in the category of a fantasy thing of giving up your job to go and do what you've always wanted to do. I've played in an amateur down-home poker game in London for about 20 years, and I'd been going to Las Vegas each May when they have the World Championships for about 10 years as a journalist to watch, because it cost $10,000 to enter, and that's an awful lot of money at the best of times. It's an awful lot of money to hand over to those sharks in 5 minutes. What happened to me in May 88 was that I arrived there and they were taking names for what they call a satellite, which is like a heat, where you put up $1,000. 10 people put up $1,000 each, play till somebody's won the lot, and that person gets into the 10,000 event for just one. It was the night I got there. I was a bit jet-lagged. I confess I'd had a couple of glasses of wine. Don't remember a whole lot about it, but I must have done something right because I won this thing and found myself playing in the World Championships. This thing goes on for 4 days. It starts with about 200 people who've paid 10,000 each, so there's about 2 million in prize money. And I lasted towards the end of the second day, and I came out 90th out of 200, which wasn't too bad for a British amateur. Got back to England, couldn't talk about anything else. And my then girlfriend, now my wife, who figures in the book as the mole, it was her idea, really, that I'd become so boring on this subject that I should just drop everything and spend a year seeing if I could pay my way.
Give us a sense of what your itinerary was, traveling around from one poker table to another for a year.
Yes, you're bobbing back and forth between tournament tables and real money tables. If I can explain the distinction, how I tried to achieve limited liability was to hit the tournament circuit, where maybe you have to pay $1,000 or $1,500 to enter a tournament, but at least that's all you can lose. In a regular poker game, of course, if you lose that, then you just dig in your pocket for more. So I was bobbing around between tournaments and real money, mostly in Nevada and California, but there were some other events. Americans come over to Europe for the European Championships, which float around. That year they were in Malta.
When you're at a casino and the people there know that you're going to be playing for big money, what are some of the perks that you get?
Oh, well, you get, as they call it, comped. When I arrive in Vegas, now that I'm a regular, I have a big white stretch limo to meet me, a big, burly terrifyingly strong-looking man to carry my suitcases, and you feel like a high roller before you've even left the airport. Then your sense of money begins to go askew, and you feel that you can't tip this guy anything less than $50, which, of course, it would have been cheaper to go by taxi, but that's what being a high roller is all about. The hotel room is free. Most of the meals are free. So you can live very cheaply in Las Vegas if they decide they like you, and if you're going to risk some money in their casino.
So what kinds of people did you play with in Vegas, for instance? What kinds of people did you play with at the World Series?
Well, part of the joy of the whole thing was that there's such wonderful, colorful, and very nice characters on the circuit. They really broadly divide into two groups. There are the old-timers who are getting on a bit now, and these are the colorful people like you see in the movies who wear Stetson hats and bootlace ties and cowboy boots and amazingly bulbous jewelry, which is a status symbol among poker players, gold encrusted rings and massive watches with diamonds glinting off them. They're wonderful talkers. And the younger pros, who are beginning to take over now, arrive at the table in tracksuits and trainers, and they really have been out jogging, these guys, and they don't smoke and they don't drink and they don't go nightclubbing and take it very seriously, and they're physical athletes as well as mental athletes. These tournaments go on a long time. They have to have powers of endurance.
Do you find that you have to be good at reading character to be a good poker player?
Very much so, yeah. That's why I think poker, as I argue in the book, is really a paradigm for life. We all bluff our way through certain situations every day, and the main requirement, if you sit down in Las Vegas or wherever at a table full of strangers, it's obviously a completely different proposition from sitting down at home with people you know inside out. And what I've got to do, or anybody else sitting down there, is evaluate these people as fast as I can. Are they rich? Are they poor? Are they happy? Are they sad? Have they got out of bed the wrong side this morning? Have they had a row with their spouse on the way to the casino? And, of course, my trouble is, as soon as I open my mouth, if only to say fold or raise, they say, hey, London, how are you doing? And they can assume from hearing my accent that I don't really know what I'm doing, which a lot of the time is true. So reading character, there's a lot of body language involved. You can tell whether people are bluffing from the way they sit, the way they perhaps tug their earlobe, things like that. That's, to me, is the fascination of it, is the kind of psychological warfare.
You say that the real pro poker players have one remarkable quality in common. They have a serene indifference to the worldly attributes of money. How did you see that around you?
I think in the end that is what sets these people apart. What they say is that money's not important. Money is just a method of keeping score. It sounds very pretentious, but in fact it's true, I think. What I mean by that is that if in those circles the bets can be in several thousand dollars, if somebody's betting $2,000 at me, I'm thinking, my God, this is a Cadillac, or this is a down payment on an apartment I could win here, or it's my children's school fees, or whatever. If you start relating it to real life, then your judgment begins to go awry. You just have to think of it as 2,000 units, think on the odds they're offering you. As long as you're doing that, you're playing rationally. In England, I keep it all in a separate bank account so that it doesn't relate to real life, and that's been very successful. But these pros can deal in huge amounts of money without thinking of them in materialistic terms at all.
What was your initial bankroll when you started?
I started out with $20,000, which sounds a lot and is a lot, but it's not a lot in that particular world. And it had dwindled down to an alarmingly low level, about $2,500 or $3,000. But I had a great turnaround weekend and was able to win the $10,000 to get into the World Series and even finish ahead.
Now, your grandfather was a millionaire who lost his fortune before you were born.
That's right.
Do you think having that kind of wealth in your family, formerly in your family, affected your view of money?
Well, I think maybe resentment that wealth isn't in my family anymore, sure, is a factor in all this. And I went to a shrink for the purposes of the book to find out why I felt I had this need for risk of a kind that most people don't seem to have in my walk of life. And he related a lot of it to my family background and the fact that my father, an otherwise upright member of a Northwest community in England, lost on the troop ship back from the war in 1945, he lost £50 sterling playing poker, which is an awful lot of money at the time, everything he had in the world. So although I grew up in a very card-playing family where we played canasta and bridge and everything you can think of, poker was strictly banned. And I got rumbled in my early 20s when I was playing bridge with my parents. They're very keen bridge players. I wasn't playing very well. My mother, as people do if they take bridge seriously, lost her temper with me and said, I can't understand why you're always overbidding. And I said, well, first of all, I don't like to have a partner. I'd rather be in charge of my own destiny. Secondly, I can't take all these conventions at bridge where if you say spades, you really mean hearts and things like that. And thirdly, of course, I'm always overbidding because I don't want to be dummy. I don't see the point of a game where you don't get to play. And this is a poker player speaking. Poker players are individualists. They don't want to have partners. And so I was rumbled. They said, you're playing poker, aren't you? And they found out. But my dad had a glint in his eye about it. And the shrink told me that I was kind of finishing off something my father started.
You're back at your Tuesday night poker game?
Oh, sure, yes. Well, there's a lot of joshing now. What's the pro going to do?
So is your playing different at the Tuesday night game now that you've had a year as a pro?
I think it's better, yes. And certainly during that year, whenever I got back home, and again, there was a lot of teasing going on, I whupped him week by week because I had much better idea in my head of the odds on the cards. I used to play from the gut, as it were, like most people do, play by instinct. But now I was playing more scientifically, and it worked. That's really the point in the end about poker, is that all other forms of gambling, casino games, blackjack, roulette, horses, whatever, you are wagering unfavorable odds. You may have a thrilling win, you see it happen at the roulette table, but you're going to lose in the end. Poker, if you know what you're doing, if you have the odds in your head, you're wagering favorable odds, and you may have a bad setback where the odds defy you, but you're going to win in the end, and that's what these people manage to do.
Well, Anthony Holden, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
And Anthony Holden's new book is called Big Deal, A Year as a Professional Poker Player.
Luck be a lady tonight. Luck be a lady tonight. Luck, if you've ever been a lady to begin with. Luck be a lady tonight. Luck, let a gentleman see how nice a dame you can be. I know the way you've treated other guys you've been with. Luck be a lady with me. A lady doesn't leave her escort. It isn't fair, it isn't nice. A lady doesn't wander all over the room and blow on some other guy's dice. So let's keep the party polite. Never get out of my sight. Stick with me, baby.
This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. As President Bush announces the shifting of forces from Europe to the Persian Gulf, two divisions, we'll hear about that news and also about what Secretary of State Baker accomplished on his latest trip that ended up in Moscow, where we speak with the reporter Thomas Friedman of the New York Times. We'll also hear about Singapore's longtime Prime Minister Lee Kuan Yew, who is stepping down, and a controversy in Wales over radar masts that are being erected there by the U.S., which the locals feel obscure a very important cathedral, which is sacred to them and to the memory of the patron saint of Wales, St. David.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Kevin Costner's new movie, Dances with Wolves, opens this weekend, and for the first time, he directs as well as stars. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review.
You've got to hand it to Kevin Costner. Other stars make speeches on behalf of the Earth and the Indians and various other worthy causes, but Costner has made a big, fat movie epic about those things. Dances with Wolves is a three-hour, $18 million ecological fantasy western, corny and old-fashioned and politically correct to a fault. And it's surprising how entertaining some of it is. But there's a lot you have to swallow. For instance, you have to swallow Costner himself as the sensitive male, circa 1864. He plays a heroic Union cavalry lieutenant named John Dunbar, who tries to get himself reassigned to the Far West. Here he is, for instance, receiving his commission from a weirdly flaky commanding officer.
I've always wanted to see the frontier.
You want to see the frontier?
Yes, sir. Before it's gone.
I am sending you on a knight's errand. You will report to Captain Cargill at the furthermost outpost of the realm, Fort Sedgwick. personal seal will assure your safety through many miles of wild and hostile country.
I was wondering.
Yes?
I was wondering, sir, how will I be getting there?
You think I don't know?
No, sir.
You think I don't know?
No, sir, it's just that I don't...
Hold your tongue. I happen to be in a generous mood, and I will grant you a boon. See that peasant out there? He calls himself Timmins. He's going to your Fort Sedgwick this very afternoon. You can ride with him if you like. He knows the way. Thank you. That is all.
Well, the frontier isn't gone yet. What's gone is Fort Sedgwick and everybody who once inhabited it. And so Lieutenant Dunbar sets out rebuilding the fort with only the help of his faithful horse and a friendly wolf. A nearby tribe of Sioux find him a pretty suspicious character, but he's so manifestly pure-hearted and open that they soon decide he's a friend. Better still, he finds an elusive herd of buffalo for them to hunt, and soon they've invited him to hunt along with them. They even give him a teepee of his own. Conveniently enough, there's a white woman in the tribe who was captured when she was a child, and she's chosen by the elders to act as translator. It isn't long before she and Dunbar are madly in love. Does this all sound fairly hokey? Well, it is. And besides, the screenplay by Michael Blake is full of dumb anachronisms, and the direction by Costner himself falls apart during some of the action scenes. Still, the movie has its own peculiar charm. By using the actual Lakota language and meticulously recreating Indian villages, costumes, and ceremonies, Costner gives us an intimacy with the Sioux that feels fresh. And though Dunbar's devotion to preserving the landscape and wildlife creates a sugary Disney version of frontier existence, Costner and his cinematographer have brought out the rough beauty of the land with extraordinary vigor. Costner's plain-spoken acting seems just right for the movie's tone, and so does the fiery performance of Mary McDonnell, playing the white woman who's grown up with the Indians. There are terrific Native American actors here, too, especially a certain Graham Greene, who has an indelible nobility as the tribe's medicine man, Kicking Bird. Dances with Wolves is a little pokey, and it sells its eco-message too hard, but in his directorial debut, Costner has acquitted himself well. You could do worse than to make a solid 50s Western in 1990.
Film critic Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Thad Kirk, Richard Parker, and Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Shen Tang, a leader in China's pro-democracy movement, talks with us about the legacy of Tiananmen Square. Also, a conversation from prison with James Fogel. His novel, Drugstore Cowboy, was the basis of the film about a crew of junkies who rob drugstores to support their habits. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.